Okay, so yeah, so today I'll start with a small, quick review of quantum field theory. So you should have seen a lot of this stuff, but the point is, I want to go back. You know, yeah, a nice spring break. I want to go back to some basic stuff, and because I want to look at two questions which may have been overlooked a little bit in your first introduction to quantum field theory. And the two basic questions is, what is particle? What do we mean by a particle in a quantum field theory context, and what do we mean by a vacuum? What do we mean by vacuum? These are very related questions, obviously, because once you define one, so that the other is referred to the other one. And a question that, just to, as an appetizer, a question that I'd like eventually for you to be able to answer, and this is essentially going to be the next tutorial on Thursday, is if you look at a curved space, for example, one of the simplest curved space that we're going to discuss is called the Sitter space, which is, you probably have seen already, it's a nice static homogeneous space. It's one of the solution with a positive cosmological constant. So that's a nice space, very relevant for cosmology. And the question is, let's say I put a stake inside of the Sitter space. The question is, does it cook? So you may have heard already about particle production, but the question I'm asking here is, is it real? If I put a stake in normal, this is a static space-time, not doing anything special, completely static, there's nothing. Let's put the stake on the geodesics, no force, no nothing. Question is, does it cook? And if it does, what's the temperature of the oven that's cooking it? Does it cook? This is like with respect to the stake. So what's the temperature of the oven? What is the temperature of oven? And so that's essentially going to be the subject of tutorial two, and hopefully we'll get to a point where you can just calculate all these things. As you may, I don't know if you know, some of you are not from Canada, you may have realized that the temperature minimum for hamburger meat is really high here. It's really annoying, actually. You cannot get, there's laws against it. So a good spin-off would be, how small does the sitter needs to be in order to respect Canadian law on hamburger meat? But let's see. Okay, so let's review. Yeah, so let's go back to this. So first, let's just review classical fields. Classical fields. So the idea is, I have my, you know, there's this bunch of them. There's going to be the real scalar field. This complex version of this thing, which is just the same thing, essentially two real fields. You have seen the gauge boson, fermions, and there's also the metric. Pretty much all the fields that we usually deal with. The idea is, these things are defined at every point in space and time, and they live in some configuration space. And for scalar, the real scalar is just a number, you know, a line. There's a line R1 going up to every point in space-time, and you just have a number here. And this thing is, the idea is, the field is varying on this line. So you have just the temperature, right, is a scalar field. And this class, we will essentially don't talk much about these guys. I mean, all of this is interesting, but in curved space-time, in particular for inflation, the scalar field and the gravitons are the more interesting one for inflation. These two guys. But so in this class, I will not discuss this. But I mean, you know, it's something you can study. I mean, this is 3 weeks class, so we can do everything. And so we'll focus mostly on the scalar field, and I'll discuss maybe a little bit the graviton later on. And so the simplest thing is to assume that this field is a free field. Then the action is the standard one. All right. So the action is standard one. So this is, say, for a free field with mass m. And now the only difference is that, unlike I'm not doing flat space, so this could be any metric. Okay? And I'm not, for the moment, including gravity, so this is just a scalar field. This would be the action for a free field, and this would obey the Klein-Gorlin equation, right? So box phi minus m squared phi is 0. Let me say a couple of things in passing about conventions. So I'm going to be following very closely Mukhanov and Winitsky. Sorry, Mukhanov and Winitsky. Particular, the order of the chapters. So this is available as a PDF. Everybody has the resource. This is really a good, I'm really going to try to follow this closely. So your question?
We have a solid copy.
You have a solid copy. Well, awesome.
That. No, that's not the black kind of book. Oh, that's it's not that?
No, 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 yeah, that's a book. Yeah. That's a book, yeah. But hopefully you can see it as a PDF. I'll be following, so, you know, if you, the notes should follow the book, at least for the first part. I'm looking at chapter 1, 3, 4, essentially, I can, these are really reviews, I can essentially almost do this today, I think. And then the order is going to be chapter 8, 6, and 7. And again, don't be too afraid. Like chapter 8 is 10 pages. I mean, this is a small book, small chapters. but yeah, so this is mostly what I'll follow. And I will follow all the conventions of this book, except one. Follow all the conventions, except there's one which I was just not able to do, is accept that my signature is minus plus plus plus, okay. Versus Mukhanov and Winitsky use plus minus minus. Okay, so this is this class. Okay, so you may have to be careful with some minus signs. I'm sorry about that. I was just not quite able to. But otherwise, all the square root of 2s and the 2 pi's, I'll be following this. Okay, and I'm sorry if I'm missing sometimes square root of 2s and 2 pi's. I'll try to get them right. Right, so this will be the Klein-Gödel equation in flat space. So this is the box operator. So in flat space, this is just in my convention. So for g mu nu equal to eta mu nu question. So this is minus phi dot dot plus, I guess the Laplacian, just let's write it as, Laplacian phi minus m squared phi 0. So this is for a free field, and the idea is we always just expand. So this I just got by varying the action with respect to phi, right? And so then, okay. So first thing is we usually to be precise in quantum field theory, we should really have a finite volume. Imagine you have some finite volume V, and then I expand phi in terms of mode in the following way. You should have seen all this, but again, because I want to go back to the beginning, I think it's good to set all the convention. So I'm expanding in terms of a momenta, tree momenta k here. So this is just a tree momenta, so kx, ky, kz. And then I have phi k as a function of t times e to the I k. Okay, so I expand in terms of a Fourier modes. In a volume, this is a discrete set, because if I have a finite volume V, normally what I'll do is I'll just say that phi of, say, x equals 0 is equal to phi x equal, say, L. So I impose a periodic boundary condition. Okay. And then what we usually do is we take the volume to infinity limit. The thing is that when you do the volume to infinity limit, you do get sometimes some divergences, which you need to be aware of. So that's why I remind you that there is really a finite, this is always better defined for finite volume in this way. Okay? Right. Then this goes up. And it's all the way up. Pretty complicated system. Okay. Note one thing first. Also, so phi k, so phi is real, right? So phi k is complex because it's e to the I k x. So that means that phi k star should be equal to phi of minus k. Okay. So when we'll promote this to an operator, this is not going to be a Hermitian operator. Like we used to, okay, because of this. But this is a small detail, but this is a source of many, many minus signs when we do this quantum field theory. Many minus signs confusion sometimes comes from there. Okay, and so the idea is that reason why we did this, so you can expand it in terms of harmonic oscillator, and the reason why we could do this is because then the equation of motion, the Klein-Gödel equation, just becomes minus phi. Should I put the minus sign here? Yeah. plus k squared over sim squared phi k. So we have an equation for each mode k to 0. And then this is just like our harmonic oscillator, right? So this is just an harmonic oscillator with frequency, with the frequency omega k equal to k squared plus m squared. Okay, so this is a standard scalar field flat space time. So it's a bunch. So what happens is if it's free, you have a bunch and not coupled harmonic oscillators with a k-dependent frequency. Okay, you can calculate the energy. Essentially, you just take, you go, this is the Lagrangian up there, so you can just use the Hamiltonian. And then the energy is going to be the sum over all k for each mode. And then you just have the kinetic energy, phi dot k, plus the potential energy. Sorry. Remember that these guys are complex. And there's a 1/2 in front of everything. OK? And often, so often, like I said, we take v to infinity. And then what happened is that the sum over k and 1 over square root of v just becomes the integral over d3k. And again, a convention here is that, you know, the 2 pi's is how do you define your Fourier transform. It does, I mean, at the end of the day, you need to get your 2 pi right to get the right answer. And so this is the convention of MW. Kind of a Winitsky. So just to put 3/2 on the k here. All right, so this is quick review of just a classical field that decomposes a series of harmonic oscillator, and then the quantum field theory aspects is just to then, you know, quantize these guys here. There's going to be, actually, just I can say right away, the particle production. What's going to happen is, so if there are just free fields like this, you're going to see first you can have a particle production that's just coming from you're changing the observer. So even if you're in flat space, you can have particle production if you're not an inertial observer. So there's going to be this particle production, PP, here. There's 3 main physical ways you can get that. There's one, you just have just observer dependent. So some observer will see particles while others won't, as I'll explain later. But the 2 other cases you can expect is one is that sometimes omega will just be a function of time. So if you're in a physical situation where the frequency of the harmonic oscillator is changing with time, then as you would expect, you should be exciting modes. Okay. So if omega k is a function of time, then you expect you'll get particle production. Okay. And the third case is the third physical sort of different is if you source the system. Source the system. So source the system means that in my action, I have the free part and I have the source. G times phi, where J here, sorry, or yeah, J is an external source. Okay? So these are 3 different ways we're gonna get particle production. But this is just just a little going ahead a bit here. Okay. So we'll need to understand essentially what we'll need to understand. So we know, you know how to quantize this. We'll need to understand how to quantize it. Well, first to be careful with observers. We'll need to learn to quantize the driven harmonic oscillator, which is this guy, or the time-dependent harmonic oscillator. Right. All right, so then let's go to quantum. This was all classical. What happened when I go to the quantum world? Well, I remind you, so the basic idea here, this method of quantizing, is we're quantizing essentially what I'm doing here is canonical quantization, which, by the way, is, you may say, if you're going to do Kerr space, canonical quantization is probably like one of the worst way to do it. Because in canonical quantization, I need to give an explicit time. I use an Hamiltonian. I need a time dependence. So it's not a very covariant approach to quantizing. And indeed, that's a problem. And there are other ways to do quantization. You can use the path integral methods, which are actually probably more covariant. But the point is, the physics is much less transparent. And also, all of the problems we do in cosmology usually have somewhat of a good definition of time. So that's why we usually prefer canonical quantization. Yes?
How did it come that omega k goes to the function of t?
Well, here it did not. This is just a flat space example. So in flat space, it's not a function of time. But if you have a situation where it was a function of t, you would get particle production. So that's just, here I'm just saying what, so in flat space, you can get particle production in fast space, but it's not going to be 2 or 3. It's going to be 1. It's going to be because you're not looking at an inertial observer. But you can have more. In cosmology, the thing is, in cosmology, we're going to look at quantum field theory in curved space. Then it's possible that these two things will happen. Either there will be a source, so it will be a driven harmonic oscillator, or it will be a time-dependent frequency. Other questions? Right, OK, so let's quantize. So yeah, so I'm doing canonical quantization. And while many people will think it's aesthetically better to do path integral when you do curved spacetime, it's just not, the physics is not transparent. And in cosmology, usually we do have a time coordinate that makes sense. And so we just use that as our time coordinate, you know. So we do canonical. Also, another thing is I'm doing Heisenberg picture, Heisenberg. Which means that the observables are a function of time, while the state is not. Okay, so a state psi is not a function of time; it's constant. Okay. All right. So now, how do you do usually just an harmonic oscillator? Well, the harmonic oscillator is just this following equation, right? And so normally, if I was doing classical, so now Q is just x. You know, this is quantum mechanics here. Okay, just harmonic oscillator. I'll go back to the fields later. So Q is just the canonical space coordinate. And then the idea is that so normally, if you do classical field theory, I can just solve this equation by just giving me what Q of T naught is, and Q dot of T naught. Just give me initial position, initial velocity, and this is solved forever. Now, in quantum mechanics, we promote Q to be an operator, Q. And we define a conjugate operator, P, which is just Q dot. So Q is, these are all function of T. And then we impose that these guys don't commute. So Q. So now you see that, so Q here, the ground state in classical theory, the ground state, which is Q equals 0, which solves the equation, given, say, an initial velocity, no initial velocity and stuff. But here, Q equals 0 is not a solution, because even though you solve the equation, you're never going to solve this, if you get Q equals 0 at all time. Note this is also the equal time. It's the equal time commutator. And so the fact that you have a, you know, that these things need to commute, you cannot just put Q equal to 0. All right, so what we do usually is we define a state and we define a wave function. Psi of Q, which for the ground state this is and let me even give you the normalization. Not really important, but so the idea is you solve this using, you know, I'm skipping a step here, but you solve this using a Schrodinger equation. This is the wave function for the ground state and for the system for an harmonic oscillator. And yeah. So I'm not going to use wave function very much. Again, this would be the path integral approach of doing things. So this is pretty much the only place where wave function will show up. At least we'll come back later maybe with wave functions, but probably more like math than me. Right, and so now you see that this is just telling you what the probability of finding, if you measure Q, what's the probability of finding it with some value, and you see that this essentially Q is the value of Q is drawn from some, so this is like the PDF, and the variance is h bar over omega. So Q now, instead of being always fixed, Q naturally vary with the variance, Q being, this is like the square root of delta Q squared. is going to be h bar over omega, roughly. OK? So the picture of the quantum world, right, it's just some jiggering around the average q equals 0. And delta q is h bar over omega. So which means that if I look at an electron and I ask what's its position, well, it's going to be in its ground state. It's going to be centered around some place. But really, it will be some cloud. And the size of this cloud is roughly going as 1 over the frequency of the electron. So this is the Compton wavelength. So if I look for an electron, it will just jiggle around. And mostly, I probably will find it around whatever position this ground state is centered at. And it will be 1 over omega. Omega is k squared plus m squared. So if you're looking for low k, at low k, the omega is just m. So it's the mass of the electron, say. All right, and so this is the usual picture for quantum mechanics. When we do quantum field theory, we promote every single of these modes to the same business. So we have now an infinite number of harmonic oscillator phi k. We have an infinite number of this dual variable. Okay. And then we just impose a commutation relation again. So now one thing is that, again, the way I'm defining things, let me first write this. This is equal time commutation. And also, let's just, for the moment, OK, h bar, well, not for the moment, for the rest of this class, h bar equals c equal 1. I'll call it that, right? So phi k pi k is I delta. So if I'm doing this in a finite volume, then this is really a Kronecker delta between the two modes. But if I do the infinite volume limit, this becomes an actual delta function. Okay. The subtleties with the sign again is that this is not an Hermitian operator technically, because I demand that phi is real. So this technically phi k here is not equal to its conjugate, you have to change to minus k. This is a standard way we do it. It creates maybe some confusion. There's a way to do this properly where these are actually Hermitian, but it's just complicated. Mukhanov in their book there, they're pretty explicit about this. And so the only thing is, like, this is create the plus sign here instead of the minus sign. These kind of, you just create some signs there, here and there, to be aware of. Yeah, so that's exactly the reason. It's because pi k, because normally this would be the relation I impose here. These are assumed to be our emissions, and these are not. They change by a k. And so this is why you get this. It'll become clearer when I write it in terms of creation and annihilation operator, because then these guys are going to be well-behaved, and they'll have a minus sign. But then you'll see that when you express those in terms of creation and annihilation, you'll get a plus sign here.
But in the finite volume limit.
Oh, is there? Oh, yeah, sorry. Very good. Sorry. That was a question. OK. You're right. Yeah, please, I hope I'm not getting all the factors right and signs. OK, and then the standard picture is we promote the wave function now to a wave functional. So instead of being a wave function of q, it's a wave function of all the possible value phi. So this is telling you the probability that you will find a scalar field everywhere in spacetime with a specific configuration. Obviously, each configuration is essentially zero. There's an infinite number of configurations. But still, it's just for if you're doing a free field, it's literally just a product of each wave function for each of the harmonic oscillator. Okay. And so up to a normalization, which I'm not carrying here, this is just going to be at d3k, 5k squared, omega k. Okay, so you just need to sum. So each one of them is our harmonic oscillator. I've put h bar to 1, but otherwise it's the same. It's the variable phi squared times the frequency. And then you just sum over all possible harmonic oscillators. OK? And so indeed, again, normally you expect that the fluctuation, therefore, for a given mode, delta phi k, the fluctuation should go as 1 over omega k, square root of omega k. Okay. Same thing as in quantum mechanics, but now for each mode. Okay. And in cosmology, we'll just have some very sometime weird function of omega k here. But that's still is always the most basic fact. Okay. Yeah, fluctuation of this order. This is in the ground state, of course, but if you're slightly away from the ground state, you don't expect that many difference. Okay. And the ground state, this is the ground state. And how we define ground state, of course, is going to be somewhat of an issue. I'm doing flat space a bit here. But this is the ground state, yep. And this is the fluctuation, and then the energy will just be the energy over the volume will just be the integral of d3k over all possible. The analog of for the quantum mechanics days is 1/2 omega k. Do I need a square? No, that's it. This is the analog of energy is 1/2 h bar omega in quantum mechanics. Okay, so it's the same thing, you just sum over all frequencies. You get a factor of v from. Because then it's in order to get the d3k here. Okay. Any questions? So this is the quick basic review of how we go from quantum mechanics, how we go from classical field to quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, we have these basic fluctuations. And now what we want to do is look back at this theory and just try to define correctly what we mean by fields, what we mean by particle, and what we mean by vacuum. From fields to particle and vacuum. Okay. You could argue that you never need to talk about particle. And in some sense, even maybe vacuum. But the basic object is a field. Okay, but still, it's useful. We always do, right? Define creation, annihilation operator, and then start talking about vacuum and particles. Yeah.
Question: what is it E over V exactly? I mean, previously we had 1 over square root of V, sum of K was.
Yeah. Did I get my square root? No, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. It's the, so over there. So phi, so 1 over square root of v sum over k becomes delta 3k. So the idea is the energy normally would be sum over k of omega k. So this would be the if I had the finite volume. And then what I do is I take v goes to infinity limit. This becomes v d3k. And then I divide by. So this is how. So I'm saying that in quantum mechanics, you get this for each mode. Sum over each mode, and then take the V infinity limit. But the problem is when you take the way we go from the sum over mode to the integral, there's a factor of V that comes in the transition. So this is over there. So when I, right. So the relation is a sum over K, 1 over V goes to d3k. This is the continuous limit.
We previously had 1 over square root of V.
Did I have one
on the middle board?
Do I need a square root of V? That sounds like a mistake to me there, sorry. Pretty sure it's 1 over V. Let me check. Mm-hmm. it's easy to figure this out. This is dimensionless, and this is, yeah, it has to be V by dimension. So the point is the sum, this is a sum over just the n, right? So this is a dimensionless sum versus this has dimension. This has dimension of 1 over volume, so I need to put a 1 over V here. Okay, so sorry, yeah, there was a square root there, it's not there. Okay, for dimension wise. Okay, good. If I can do a if we can spot all my mistakes, that's great. It's going to be error free, which would be awesome. So from fields, particle, and vacuum. Right, okay, so now the idea, so I can write my equation of motion for phi dot equal phi k, which also, oh, okay, yeah, this 1 over v here, by the way, that means that in my definition of phi here, it probably should be 1 over v as well, again, for dimension wise. Change 1 over square root everywhere. But I'll recheck that next time to make sure. The point that's important is that because we'll always almost work in the v goes to infinity limit, just know that we do the expansion d3k here with no v whatsoever. Okay. So so the 1 over v only appears in when you do it the finite volume. So this is the Fourier. This is our convention for Fourier transform in the continuous limit. Okay, no v here. Which hopefully agrees with that one once you fix it. OK, so now I have phi dot. So I can write my equation of motion. So I have phi dot equal pi. This is the definition of pi here, the conjugate variable. These are vectors. And then I have pi. This is an operator. Phi dot equal minus omega square k phi k. This is another way to write the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay, so this is the Klein-Gordon equation. All right, again, these are all vectors. This is vectors, but this is not actually. This is a norm, right? The frequency never depends on the frequency here. This is always the norm. K here is the norm of the vector. Right, and so I have, so this is the Klein-Gordon equation. When you put these two together, you get the Klein-Gordon equation. And then I have the commutation relation, phi k. Phi k prime at the same time is equal to I delta k plus k prime. Right, and so the usual way to get to particles, we'll just define creation and annihilation operator. So let's write a minus k. This is going to be my annihilation operator. And it's defined from complete analogy with what we do in quantum mechanics. It's defined as phi k. Plus I by k over omega k. Okay, and then we'll define the creation operator, which is my notation on the board is never going to be. So this is plus, but it also is dagger. So this is a minus dagger. And this is T. Yeah, I don't know how to do a dagger. Phi minus K minus I pi minus K over omega K. Okay, so these are vectors. This is not a vector. But now you see that when I took the dagger on the annihilation operator, I got minus phi of minus k instead of phi of k. Okay. So this is the creation. So this is going to be the creation and annihilation operator. They're defined exactly as we used to define them in quantum mechanics. Now using this relation here, you can show that a minus and a plus. One thing is that now these are actually function of time, because these guys are a function of time. Not function of space, just function of time. So a minus k of t And usually, well, very soon I'll get rid of that function of time because we don't like that usually. So k prime of t is equal to delta k minus k prime. And so now you have the usual minus sign convention. Because essentially, we have 5k times 5 minus k. OK? And then you have the usual relation that a minus commuting with a minus and a plus with a plus is 0. OK? Now, the trick is that these operator a plus and a minus obey a very nice equation. You just invert this relation for phi and pi, and then find what phi and pi are in terms of a's into this equation, and you'll find that ddt of a plus minus of t for a given k is equal to plus minus I omega k a plus minus kt. Okay, so this is all in, again, I'm doing the flat space. Free field, you know, this is, we'll generalize all of this. But the point is, you see, this creation and annihilation operator are eigenvector of the ddt operator with frequency, with eigenfunction plus minus I omega. Okay? So we usually can say this is like the a plus is the positive frequency, will be the positive frequency mode, and the minus I omega will be the negative frequency mode. So we can also solve this equation in flat space. So I assume that omega k is not a function of time here. You can just solve this. Then you find that a k of t here is the usual operator times e to plus minus I omega. So I define just a constant here. So this is an operator. This is an operator. So this is a constant now operator, and then I have the frequency modes. Okay. Huh. So this one doesn't move. This guy. Has to be reimbursed. This is not part of my contract. No. Okay. So can you see? Yeah. I can raise it. Oh no. Okay. This is the front one that doesn't move. Okay. It does move. Doesn't move as well. All right, it moves. OK, good. All right, OK, good. Right. So these guys now are time independent. This is what we usually will call an annihilation and creation operator. So I'm in the Heisenberg picture. So normally, observables, operators are function of time. But we'll always essentially define creation and annihilation operator to be independent of time. And we'll just take the time dependence out and you know, solve it. These are time independent. Okay? And from now on, this is essentially going to be this is all the creation and annihilation operator. Oh, wow. I need to be faster in annihilation operator. All right.
Question?
Yes.
How do you get the differential equation for A?
So what I did is skip any steps. Now, so what I did, I took, you can invert phi and pi in terms of, write them in terms of a plus and a minus. I'll do this actually right now, essentially. So you write phi and pi in terms of a plus and a minus. Then you plug it back in here. And then that gives you an equation for a's. Because I'm just saying, you know, this is a function of time. So I just put it in here. And if omega is constant, then you get that. Other questions? Right, so you can exactly. So I can invert. Invert back this relation, and then I have the decomposition that the operator phi k vector is just 1 over square root of 2 omega k. And the square root of 2 is convention that I actually usually wouldn't have it, but this is Mikhanov and Winnitsky, and I think it's the one that makes more sense. But the harmonic oscillator connection. So maybe that's why they chose it. But anyway, so a minus k where now this is not a function of time, e to the minus I omega k t, and then plus a plus minus k. Do I need a minus here? I guess I do. Omega k t. Okay, so again, here, I skip a couple of steps. You just take these two relations and just, you know, add a minus plus a plus, cancel these guys. You see, you get, you need, in order for it to be phi k, I need to redefine this one to be a of minus k, a dagger of minus k. This is also an operator. And this is a vector here. Okay? So now the usual notion in the harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics is that a plus would be the creation operator. So I can define, normally I would just say I can define a vacuum a minus k such that is 0 for all k. Okay, so I just define my vacuum. I say this guy is annihilate the vacuum for all k. And then I can use the a plus, the creation operator, to populate this vacuum. Okay? So this would be the natural, so this would be what you call the natural vacuum choice. And then I can create an arbitrary populated state. Let's write it. That's fine. As some product of, I apply some A dagger KS, so some given set of Ks. I apply this a certain number of time NS, and I normalize them, if you want to, apply on the vacuum. So what is this? This is a state which has n1 particle. It says n1 particle of momentum k1. So this is how we usually define particles. And then n2 particle momentum k2. Okay. So this is how you would, this is probably how you've seen it, okay? But now there's some ambiguity here with the choice of particle. And the reason is because, well, when I did this mode decomposition, it really was somewhat arbitrary that I kind of choose this basis here. What if I had chosen, instead of expanding phi in terms of e to the I omega, I mean, essentially, it's how I define a minus and a plus. So I define it like this, but I could have chosen to define like cosine and sine. If you think of this guy as just a mode decomposition, just think of an operator in the decomposition mode, then there's a lot of different ways you could have decomposed them. And then it will be different notion of particles. So this is part of the ambiguity. The other is that now, in flat space, something special happened. This one is okay. In flat space, or Minkowski, not just flat, but Minkowski space. There is a very special notion of time. Okay, that we have a Poincaré group. This is the group of symmetry. And so what happened is that what we find is a plus a minus, where really, how do I want to say this? Yeah, so they were eigenfunction. I already sort of said it. Eigenfunction of ddt. This operator ddt. And ddt is a special vector in Minkowski space. Essentially, there's time translation. There's time translation in Minkowski space. So what happens is this is a Killing vector of the space. So I don't know, have you seen Killing vector somewhere in some classes? You seen a Lie derivative? Yes. OK, good. So the Lie derivative, a Killing vector is when the Lie derivative essentially is just the directional derivative for scalars. And this one doesn't move, right? So the Lie derivative, so a Lie derivative is just a directional derivative. You can take a Lie derivative of a tensor, and a Killing vector is a vector for which the Lie derivative of the metric is 0. So this is a Killing vector. Okay. And the idea is that in flat space, ddt is a Killing vector. So there's a natural notion of that there's an isometry of the space-time, so it's just time translation. And then this A is a natural eigenfunction of this the scaling vector. So there's a natural notion of positive and negative frequency with respect to this t of the t variable. So you just, there's natural time variable. Really, all we're saying here. Natural variable time in Minkowski space. And then all initial aren't inertial detectors. Will measure the same number of particle. Measure the same particle content, if you want. The same particle content. Because all of these inertial detectors would agree with this definition of A plus minus. So as long as you're inertial, you all measure the same particle content. So it's not super satisfactory because even in flat space, I could be a non-inertial detectors. I could be an observer which is not moving on just some geodesics. For example, so next class, we'll do the Unruh effect where I'm an observer which is accelerated. If so, even in flat space, this notion of particle is flawed. Okay. But more importantly, it says, why do we bother even defining particle? Because you see, in this framework, particle is a global concept. It's not local. Let's go back to this one. So if you're trying to do something in Kirchhoff, because you could have said, well, if Minkowski is special, if there's a nice notion of time in Minkowski, and I know what to do, and there's a Killing vector, then I could always just say, well, locally, space-time, in any curved space, locally, it will be Minkowski. If it's small enough, I'll just approximate it with flat space. Then I'll define my notion of particle locally. But you can't do that. You cannot define particle locally. You cannot define the notion of particle. You cannot define particle, the notion, locally. And that's because, and this is the same thing as saying as I cannot define vacuum locally. And that's because I'm working, well, first of all, I'm just working in the Heisenberg picture, right? So psi is not even a function of time. States in quantum mechanics are defined globally. They're defined everywhere. Okay. So if somehow we live in a universe which eventually will collapse to a singularity, when you define your quantum state, you should know about the fact that in the future will be ending in a singularity because you have to define psi everywhere in space and everywhere in time. So it's a very global concept. It's very hard, in fact, to make, oh, am I going to do something covariant when I'm starting with, you know, with states like this? So what happened is I could have two people in a different room. They measure space-time locally. Then they will define a vacuum locally. They'll say, locally, I measure no particle. But then their notion of vacuum is supposed to be used everywhere in space-time. And the idea is it will not agree. For different observers will not think that the vacuum was free of particle. Okay, let me explain this a bit more.
So let's say you cannot define particle globally.
I'm sorry?
You cannot define a particle globally.
You cannot agree on what.
But you can locally.
You cannot define particle globally. Sorry. Yeah, this is a cannot. Thank you. Globally. Words don't agree with my, okay, yeah. I cannot define particle globally. I cannot, I was right, sorry. I cannot define the notion of particle. I mean, I can, local observer won't agree the notion of particle. This is a global concept. Okay. What I want to say here is this is a global concept. When you define this, you use a state which is defined everywhere. And then you use A plus A minus, which are not a function of time either. Okay, so they'll be defined at all time again. Now I'm using again to do the particle analogy. What I did is I expanded normally the observable is a function of time, but then I expanded in a time independent piece, and then some space, you know, some time, some function of time here. And the idea is this notion of particle that we define in usual quantum mechanics is something that should be valid at all time. Yes.
So the only requirement for having particles will define this global time-like thing like that.
That helps. But actually, even in cases where you have a globally defined timeline killing vector, you still might be interested in looking at different observers, because even in flat space, observers which are not necessarily inertial will detect particles. And so, for example, in flat space, the idea is that there is a globally defined timeline killing vector. So this is this DDT. And all inertial detectors, all inertial observer, what you would call walking in a, you know, going on your geodesics, will agree with that. So there's just like, it's just a natural time. But even in the sitter, where there is also a globally defined time-like killing vector, there's just many different observers which you might be interested in asking a question about, and they wouldn't agree what the notion of particle is. And that's because there is a horizon. So even though there is a time-like killing vectors, some observers don't see everything in the space-time. And so, since this is all global, these states are defined globally, if you don't see all of space-time, then clearly you should have a different vacuum than others. So it's not enough. I mean, even in flat space, I mean, having the notion of particle is not only depends on your observer, and it depends on your choice of vacuum. And so even in cases where there's no time dependence, there's no nothing like flat space, you can be a detector which detects particles. You can be in a state where you will detect particles. I mean, again, so let's say you have, to give you an example. I have Alice here and Bob living in a space-time. And Alice, where she lives, it's essentially flat space. So she would define a natural A minus and A plus and her flat region of space-time. And she would have a vacuum. Let's call it Alice's vacuum. And then Bob also, say, lives also in a very far away region from Alice, but it's also nearly flat where he is. So he will define A plus A minus, and he will define a vacuum. So these are two flat space regions. So if it's a flat space region, I can just literally do what I did in this lecture, and I'm just having things. But it could be all sort of things happening here in between. It could be black holes. It could be all sort of things. But when you define this guy, it's supposed to be defined everywhere. In particular, it's supposed Alice can use Bob's vacuum. And the idea is that even two flat region here, the vacuum that these two guys define may actually be different. And so that if Alice use her creation and annihilation operator with Bob's vacuum, she could detect particle. So in other words, Bob's vacuum would be, I should use B here, sorry. Let's say these are different creation and annihilation operator. So B minus, Bob defined this way. But that doesn't necessarily mean that A minus, the operator defined by Alice on Bob's vacuum, this is not going to be necessarily zero. Okay, so it's not a big deal. It makes sense. You just have to, you know, be careful with this. Yes.
Can you explain again what you mean by E plus minus is an eigenfunction?
I mean, just this equation there. So DDT acting on A plus and minus is plus minus I omega here. So it's really, this is true, you know, in flat space here, that these guys are eigenfunction of this vector, if you want,
so
of this operator, DDT.
How do you see that this corresponds to the inertial observer seeing the same?
No, it's not. Again, it's not. It's just that if everybody in flat space uses the same time coordinates, which every inertially moving person would choose T as his natural coordinates. And then you define this, your A plus and minus this way, then you will have the same definition of A plus and minus and the same definition of vacuum. So if you use the same time, if two observers use the same time coordinate, and then they would agree, and they're both in flat space, they would agree what the number of particle is and what the vacuum is. But if you're, even if you, so if the time coordinate changes in some sense, this is what, you know, in curved space, if the notion of time changes from one region to the other, even though this is flat, so Alice, close by, she defines a natural time coordinates, and she has A plus A minus, which are defined positive and negative frequency. So she has a good notion of what positive and negative frequency. She has an arrow of time in some direction. Bob is also in flat space. It also has an arrow of time, but these two don't have to agree, because in the general space-time, this could be flat, but they don't, you know, there could be stuff going on in between. So positive negative frequency here might not agree with positive negative frequency here. What I call positive, what it calls negative. And then so that means that this guy will say, I see particle production compared to this one. Okay. And this could be in the future. So it could be that Alice in the past, the space-time is flat. She defines, she sets this a quantum state, and she says, I don't want any particle in it, in the far past. Then let it evolve, it hits a black hole for a while, the universe was inflating, it's the sitter, blah, blah, blah. Bob at the end is living also in flat space. And then he checks what's coming in Alice and says, this is not a vacuum, I'm sorry. You set it in the vacuum, but as far as I can tell, there's tons of stuff in it. Well, you can think of this as, well, particle was produced on their way, or since these guys are defined for all time, it's just saying that this state has particle in this state. Okay. Is that? We'll work out some equations. Hopefully, all of this will be clear. Any other questions? You can define, you know, you could do this without ever talking about particles and vacuum. You could always talk about local quantities. You know, I could calculate the expectation value of the stress energy tensor at some position in time in some vacuum. So I have to tell me what the vacuum is. Could be Bob or Alice. At least what's good about these kind of things is this, like, this is something that observer would agree. Is that a question? Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Can't they both agree on a vacuum? So, for example, both A minus and B minus on that would be zero?
Well, yeah, and in some cases they can, and sometimes, I mean, I can always make up. I could always make, I could say I'm going to choose a time coordinate. I can always choose Alice's vacuum here. I can say I'm Bob, and I say, okay, I'm going to choose a creation. I can choose my vacuum to be Alice's, and then we'll agree. But it's just that this would not be the natural for an initial detector here. This would not be. So in other words, Bob could move his detector, accelerate his detector. It could undo the particle creation that happens here. It's just so that now it says, now I'm detecting nothing in Alice's vacuum because now I'm accelerating. So you can move. So in fact, this is somewhat weird because there's some particle production which is very real. You know, the frequency is changing, or you're pumping, you're having driven harmonic oscillator. So you're really actually exciting the states. And yet I could undo this very real, very physically meaningful particle production. I can undo it by simply moving around. So it's a bit confusing. There's an observer-dependent part of particle production, and there's a very physical part when the frequency is changing or when the harmonic oscillator is driven. So in the first, in fact, so tomorrow we'll do the Unruh effect, which is the observer-dependent part of particle production. But then most for cosmology, most of the time we're interested in the case where it's the frequency is changing in time, not the observer. We're just going to fix the observer somewhere. But it's important to do the Unruh because you have to realize that indeed you can just move around and undo what seems to be a particle production. But just one thing about local quantities. So I've been talking these states and particles are sort of global quantities. This is a local quantity defined at x and t. And the point is, for example, if this is zero for Alice, it's going to be zero for everybody, for Bob and so forth. Okay. So local quantities in some sense are way better. And also, if it's not zero, then at least you know it transformed. You know, this is a tensor, so you can tell. So observers will agree on things. Okay. Right. I think I'm supposed to finish, right? No, but okay. Any other questions? Yes.
So will it be the same with respect to the vacuum for everyone, or?
No. But given a vacuum, so as soon as you take the same vacuum, this would be zero for. But yeah, it depends on the vacuum. The answer will depend on the choice of vacuum. So everybody should use the same vacuum. But if it's zero somewhere and say it's time, it's going to stay zeros everywhere. And if it's not zero, you know how you can transform it by doing a change of coordinate transformation. So local quantities are still very well defined. But global quantities can be tricky sometimes. Other questions? All right, OK. So see you tomorrow.